I'd like to welcome everybody out today. We are in session 351, Mormon Soldiers Capture Saddam Hussein, Mormon Urban Legends. So if you need to be somewhere else, leave now. Today we will be hearing first from Robert Rees, Ph.D. He is the Director of Education and Humanities at the Institute of HeartMath and editor of Proving Contrarities, a collection of writings in honor of Eugene England. We'll also be hearing as a respondent from Alan Roberts, former editor of Sunstone Magazine and co-editor of Dialogue, and he owns an architectural firm here in Salt Lake City. We also have a digital recording going on of the session, so hopefully that introduction will be on there. I would like to remind everybody to turn off his or her cell phone, pager. If you have any of those, you know, birthday tweeter things, put them away. And we'll have time for question and answer afterwards. If you would please just come up to this mic that I'm at now, and we'll be able to get everybody's question as well as the answers recorded. Thank you. Robert?
I just finished an hour interview with Mark England recounting my memories of his father, and so my heart is very full of the remembrances of our dear friend and brother Gene England. In this paper that I've gotten, I talk about urban legends and kind of the function that they provide in a society. And in the interest of time, I want to get to those legends and to talk about their meaning. So I'm going to dispense with four pages of introductory material and go immediately to these urban legends. The group of Mormon urban legends I've chosen for this presentation all originated after 9/11. And all have to do with the so-called War on Terror. Legends tend to proliferate during times of great crisis, and one could speculate the greater the crisis or perceived threat, the more dramatic and miraculous the legend. The terrorist attack on America and subsequent attacks on other nations by radical Islamists, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the broiling conflict in the Middle East, global warming, and cataclysmic natural disasters, and other seemingly apocalyptic events have all led to a dramatic increase in fear and anxiety among the general populace. Therefore, it is not surprising that there are a number of such legends associated with these events, nor that some of these are distinctly Mormon. The first Mormon legend having to do with the terrorist attack and and their aftermath emerged almost immediately after 9/11. Within days of the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and the failed attack on the White House, stories began circulating that no Mormons were killed on that day. According to one version of this legend, quote, Bishop Gonzalez of the Hollywood Ward in the Los Angeles stake reported that although 48 Mormons worked in the World Trade Center, not one member, parentheses, in good standing, of the Mormon Church died in the World Trade Center collapse on 9/11/2001. When questioned about the validity of the report, the bishop has claimed to have replied that it came, quote, by way of an internal memo sent to all bishops and stake presidents by President Hinckley, end of quote. This has all the characteristics of the typical legend. It is reported by someone who heard it or knew someone who did. It includes specific, if inaccurate or intentionally fraudulent, information and data. For example, the name of the bishop and the fact that there were 48 members of the church who worked in the World Trade Center. It has apparent authoritative support, an internal memo from President Hinckley, and it includes information that, while perhaps slightly incredible on one level, is nevertheless plausible, especially if one considers the percentage of Latter-day Saints in the general population of the Eastern Seaboard. On closer examination, however, there are elements that might undermine confidence in the veracity of the story, including the fact that it was only active Mormons who were saved. No Sunstoners, no doubt. When the story was posted on an internet blog, one correspondent asked how many inactive members were killed, to which another, obviously more skeptical blogger, responded, all of them the bloody heathens. Interestingly, according to Mary Ellen Robertson, quote, there was an article in the Deseret News published on September 12, 2001, indicating that no New York church members or missionaries had perished in the tragedy. Later, news reports indicated that, in fact, a number of Mormons had been killed in these events. What do these legends tell us about ourselves? Those that are based essentially on real-life events and which correspond with a reasonable degree of verisimilitude to actual events may do no more than illustrate the human proclivity for exaggeration and hyperbole, especially when it comes to matters of self-interest or self-promotion. That is, all of us expand, with some degree of creative invention, the stories we tell about ourselves and those we repeat about our families, our friends, and our fellow believers. Like all storytelling, such narratives are arranged in order to make them more dramatic. We all want our lives to be more heroic than they are, our children to be smarter and more beautiful than other children, our churches to be the one and only true church, our lives to be more meaningful, our memories to be honored. And so we distort and invent, and sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously, until with the passage of time, even we no longer are able to distinguish between what really happened and what we wish or imagine had happened. Some stories, however, and those that are essentially manufactured out of whole cloth, are less benign. These are intentional fabrications, lies told in the service of convincing ourselves and others that we are the objects of special providence, that we are God's chosen people and enjoy a state of grace superior to others. Like stories told by any group which feels it is chosen or highly favored of divinity, these legends reinforce an elitist sentiment. The lesson is that although others, no matter what religion or degree of righteousness, whatever they may suffer or be killed by, or they may suffer or be killed by terrorists, God intervenes in the lives of Latter-day Saints to save them. Thus, a Catholic archbishop or a Jewish rabbi might be killed in such an event, but not a tithe-paying, temple-worthy Latter-day Saint elder. The latter would be spared simply because he happened to hold the priesthood and belonged to the one and only true church. An alternate legend about 9/11 is a report that a large missionary zone conference was scheduled to take place in the World Trade Center on the day the terrorists struck, but that none of the missionaries headed there was able to reach his or her destination. Miraculously, alarm clocks failed to go off, automobiles broke down, bus connections were missed. There's such a need to believe these stories that most people don't stop to consider the likelihood of a missionary conference being scheduled in the World Trade Center, or more significantly, to consider the character of a God who would not intervene to stop the terrorists from their destruction of so many innocent lives, but who would intervene in multiple minor ways. Excuse me. Something happened to page 10. Multiple minor ways to stop these missionaries from reaching their destination. A third legend having to do with 9/11 is one having to do with the Tabernacle Choir. Tabernacle Choir is scheduled to make a concert in London on the day of the terrorist bombings in London, but miraculously are forbidden from doing so because President Hinckley is able in December, before the terrorist attacks, which happened a year ago in July, in December of the year before that, President Hinckley canceled the choir's attendance there. And the legend reports that the choir was supposed to give a concert on the very day of the terrorist attacks, that they were going to leave from King's Cross Station to go to Scotland, and King's Cross Station was one of the ones in which there was a terrorist bomb. And all of these things did not happen because the prophet of the church, prescient, receiving a revelation, inspired, canceled the church, the Tabernacle Choir's tour. Well, Shields, which is a website devoted to debunking Mormon myths and legends, said, the church's public affairs department and the publicist of the Tabernacle Choir, Michael von Rosen, reported that the trip planning was not far enough along to determine which subway the choir might use, and besides, since the choir normally travels on private buses, not public transportation, it is unlikely that it would have had even used the subway. The choir publicist also confirmed that The choir would not have arrived in London until 10 days after the bombing. As with other such myths and legends, there is a didactic purpose to this story. Listen to the prophet, quote, listen to the prophet even if his instruction does not seem to make sense. It is true that President Hinckley apparently canceled the choir's tours, but it's because of a general unrest in the world and not because he thought or knew there was going to be a terrorist bombing. Anyway, the purpose of this story, listen to the prophet even if his instruction does not seem to make sense. He is truly a prophet of God and still guides and leads the members of the church through dangerous times and can lead us to safety. Or, as one of the narrators of this legend put it, they don't call this Hinckley guy a prophet for nothing. The people who tell and pass on such stories don't seem to ask such questions as, if President Hinckley had received such an impression or revelation concerning danger to the choir, why wouldn't he have wanted to convey that information to the British government so that the lives of all of those in harm's way would have been spared? But of course, that would take away the essential purpose of the story, which is to confirm the fact that Latter-day Saints enjoy the special protection of the heavens. A third legend that having to do with the terrorist attack are the numerous rumors that Osama bin Laden has been hiding in various parts of the West, including Salt Lake City, where he's been seen by a number of people. Apparently, a familiar desert landscape and a hospitable place in which to continue his polygamous marriages, to say nothing of being one of the least locations in the world where people would be looking for him, brought him to the Great Basin. According to the Salt Lake Tribune, federal agents in Salt Lake City say they have received dozens of reports that the accused terrorist mastermind has been spotted on the freeway, in the mall, or enjoying a Big Mac and fries at McDonald's. No doubt supersized. FBI Special Agent Kevin Eaton is quoted as saying, it's pretty surprising how many people really believe he's here. Another urban legend, this one was sent to me by a friend, said, thought you would find this timely. It came from a friend of ours. Tonight, my visiting teachers, the Lovelands, you've got to believe anything visiting teachers say, right? They brought some photos of their grandson, Sergeant Schwab, that he sent to them. I asked their permission to share it with my friend. Sergeant Schwab, who in Iraq had a set of scriptures taped together to make a quad. He had been reading his patriarchal blessing the night before and tucked it into the pages of his scriptures, and the next morning picked them up and tucked them into his shirt and his bulletproof vest. Sergeant Schwab led a troop that morning and was rounding a corner when he was met by an Iraqi with a rifle. The Iraqi fired four bullets into his chest, then ran out of bullets. Sergeant Schwab stood there, waiting to fall to the ground dying, but instead grabbed his pistol and shot the Iraqi dead. It was discovered that the Iraqi bullets penetrated the bulletproof vest and went through the scriptures, but stopped right at the pages just before the patriarchal blessing. Days later, their military vehicle was hit by an artillery and literally melted to the ground. The next day, Sergeant Schwab found that the scriptures were laying on the dashboard and only the outside of the pages had been burned. Amazing. The person sending it said, I have attached the files, which are virus-free. I made them myself. And with this file were photographs of a Book of Mormon with bullet holes in it and some of the burned pages, but not the book itself preserved. So the conclusion could be that God makes a bullet enter the scriptures, but stop just short of a patriarchal blessing, which gives the paper on which patriarchal blessings are written enormous power. And also that God preserves a book, but not people, at least not non-Latter-day Saints. I sent this to one of my more skeptical friends who wrote back, the moral of this story is, on patrol, never pack less than a fully loaded quad. A related and more elaborate and more dramatic Mormon urban legend relating to 9/11 is the one about Mormon soldiers fighting in Iraq. According to this legend, which circulated on the internet and in high priest group meetings, which is a fertile ground for Mormon urban legends, including recently in my own ward, according to this legend, members of the 1457th Utah National Guard Engineering Battalion are credited with almost single-handedly winning the initial campaign in the war on Iraq. The story reports that these particular soldiers were required to go on such dangerous missions that, quote, they were told to prepare messages and letters to their families and to plan funerals since the majority of them would not be coming back. So certain was their demise that, quote, the President of the United States wrote a letter of apology to them. The fabricator of the story can't help but slip in a little conservative politics into his narrative. We are told that this engineering unit had to go to Iraq, quote, because the 11 regular Army combat engineering units were too badly depleted during the Clinton administration to be combat ready. In this particular legend, Mormon soldiers are credited with capturing Saddam Hussein, pulling down Saddam Hussein's statue, capturing the first Iraqi prisoners of war, winning a number of strategic battles, all without losing a single soldier. They were on some of the most dangerous missions, missions in which other soldiers were killed, but they were not. Quote, more often than once, Jack, the supposed son of the narrator, came out alive, unscathed from a destroyed Humvee. When a squad took casualties, the ones walking away from it always included the combat engineers from Utah. The soldiers were so inspired in battle that they seemed to have special insight as to where they should lead other soldiers. Mormon soldiers, many of whom are returned missionaries, seemed to have special channels through which they received revelations on the battlefield, and which they performed miracles in combat and inspired others. Quote, only the true spirit would lead men to say and do such great things. Mormon soldiers didn't just supply specific intelligence to fight specific battles, but they were the source of the general intelligence for the war. Quote, much of the intelligence for the war comes out of Draper, Utah, right here. The translation and analysis comes out of the linguistic group there. According to the legend, extraordinary exploits of Mormon soldiers, quote, prompted a full-scale investigation into them without even their knowledge. Now regular Army spooks were following them around everywhere they went and reporting every small thing they did and asking other soldiers about them. The general story coming back was that they were essentially extremely religious guys who had close friends, that is, returned missionaries, everywhere, and all of them were afraid of nothing. They must have led some kind of unexplained, charmed life. There was no logic at all in the way they came back unharmed over and over again. Beyond their remarkable performance on the battlefield, these soldiers had a profound influence on the religious scene in Iraq. They held worship services and, quote, special prayer circles that became so popular that, quote, standing room only meetings were held every hour on the hour from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., which could explain why we might be losing that war. So many Latter-day Saints and other soldiers attended these Mormon services that the only place large enough to hold the services was Saddam Hussein's huge residence, which the Mormon soldiers had, quote, cleaned out for this very purpose. But even that was not large enough because before long one could see the, quote, desert covered with men in prayer circles, arms wrapped around each other's shoulders. Soon this became one great awakening throughout the valley of the Euphrates. Quote, as time went on, the prayer circles were held after lights out in tents all over Iraq. Before long, one could hear the strains of I am a child of God thread throughout the desert. Hearing the accomplishments of these Mormon soldiers, quote, many times, a senior officer would break down in tears and ask, what kind of people are we commanding anyway? So remarkable were the accomplishments of this battalion that, according to the legend, the Pentagon ordered an investigation. Their heroic exploits were so astonishing that, quote, five senior generals visited with a group of general authorities to commend the church for producing such extraordinary young men. Called our modern-day stripling warriors, this legend is replete with the language of special providence and miraculous deliverance. Quote, never before in American military history has any assault engineering unit gone into war and not suffered heavy casualties until now. It was not a coincidence that a Utah boy found Saddam. It was also a Utah guardsman who threw a rope around Saddam's statue and pulled it down with the world watching. The soldiers are called miracle men. Others regarded their accomplishments with amazement. The narrative reports on, quote, unexplainable things happening, at least unexplainable in ordinary terms. The narrative suggests that all of this was according to divine plan. Why were these Mormon soldiers sent to Iraq in the first place? The answer is found in the response of one of the soldiers to his father. You see, Dad, it wasn't just the president that sent us there, at least not the national kind. The Lord sent us to Iraq to start something for him. Not since the days of Abraham has there been any significant Melchizedek priesthood presence in Babylon. We talked about it a lot among ourselves. We all knew that the Lord was doing something special and decided we'd keep our mouths shut and just get on with it. It's a powerful faith-promoting story. Unfortunately, almost none of it is true. Jan Harold Brunvald, folklorist at the University of Utah, describes urban legends as, quote, true stories that are too good to be true. They're also too neatly plotted to be believed, although they are believed, as this one certainly is. So embarrassed over this story was the army itself that it produced three separate responses to quell and quash it, including one by James A. Montoya, battalion chaplain, Major Lorraine Janizelli, spokesperson for the Utah National Guard, and Lieutenant Colonel Jefferson S. Burton, the commander of the 457th Engineering Combat Battalion. Major Janizelli stated, "Our service was not particularly unique. Sadly, the lies and sanctimony expressed in the fictional email cheapens the dedicated service of honest members everywhere." And Colonel Burton countered the legend by in detail saying, "I will refute the lies told in this fabrication point by point. We were not sacrificed troops. The president did not send us letters of apology. Excuse me. Sergeant Jack does not exist anywhere but in the mind of the author. The 1457th did not engage the enemy from Kuwait to Baghdad. We did fight as a unit, but were not divided up among other units. We did not serve with the 3rd Marines. We did not engage in hand-to-hand combat with the enemy. We did not find Saddam Hussein. We did not rescue the first prisoners. We did not fight ahead of the main force. We were not considered chaplains by other soldiers. We held services in a tent, not in Saddam's palace. We had very few, if any, visitors to our Sunday services. No general officers attended our church service. We held no prayer circles. Pete, the so-called technical service vendor for the Utah Guard, exists only in the mind of the author. Senator Hatch did not complain to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, asking if they were trying to kill his Utah Guardsmen. We were not responsible for the combat operations performed by any other units. We were not the spearheads for the 3rd Marines or the 101st Airborne. We did not teach the Army how to pray. They already knew how." Well, the one element of the narrative that was factual was that the battalion did not suffer any casualties during its tour of Iraq and during its tour of duty in Iraq. Although the battalion chaplain speaks of their miraculous protection and says, "It was miraculous we had no serious combat injuries," and testified, we were protected and strengthened by the power of the Lord, he also reveals that the unit, quote, arrived in Iraq after major operations, combat operations had ceased. Although Chaplain Montoya says, "I'm certain that the authors of this legend had no intention of deceiving anyone by sharing our story," it is difficult not to conclude otherwise, especially given its wholesale invention and fabrication. One might be tempted to consider such a tale benign. While one might be tempted to consider such a tale benign, it is dangerous to do so, mainly because it reinforces the sentiment that Mormons are so special that they deserve divine protection and guidance not afforded others. In the language of the legend, the Pentagon had ordered an investigation into every small thing about our particular group of soldiers, trying to figure out what was different about them, why they were so special. Over a century ago, William Graham Sumner coined the term ethnocentrism to describe the human phenomenon which David Berry terms sovereign humankind, the quote view in which one's own group is the center of everything and all others are scaled in reference to it. In his newly published book, Us and Them, Understanding Your Tribal Mind, Barraby explores the way the human mind establishes a hierarchy of humankinds. Human beings have an immense mental apparatus for matching the world of humankinds. And he goes on to talk about how we have a proclivity to make our people the ones who are special and diminish others. If someone is a member of the same humankind as you are, then his behavior is, in a sense, yours as well. Thus, showing the Mormon soldiers in Iraq as larger than life, as the legend puts it, superior soldiers, one pictures Arnold Freeberg's heroic, muscular Sons of Helaman or Captain Moroni in full combat gear, in some ways may make us feel that we too are extraordinary, that we too could walk into the lion's den of war, do mighty things, and by the special grace of God, walk out unscathed. In an article in the Wall Street Journal entitled, "Our Brains Strive to See Only the Good, Leading Some to God," Sharon Begler reports how our brains, quote, interpret unexpected and even unwanted outcomes as being for the best. Begley cites the work of Professor Daniel Gilbert of Harvard, who states, "People don't know how good they are at finding something desirable in almost any outcome. So when there is a good outcome, they're surprised and they conclude that someone else has engineered their fate." One of the effects of this process is that it may lead Mormons either to dismiss or diminish the tragedy and sufferings of others. If God saves Mormons but not others in such situations, then he must not save others either because they are not special and deserving or for some reason known only to him. If God manipulates world events and intervenes in such specific ways in the lives of the saints, then Mormons can be assured that, quote, God is in his heaven and all is right with the world, at least for us. Conveniently, we don't have to wonder about the tens of thousands of innocent Iraqi citizens killed in the war, many by our own bombs and bullets. Somehow, perhaps, because they are Muslim, they get what they deserve, or are unfortunate if necessary collateral damage in the war on terror. With so much evidence as we are confronted with in such places as Iraq, Darfur, and Palestine, more recently in Lebanon, throughout the developing world where tens of thousands of children suffer and die daily for want of food and medicine or because of violence, how can we not at least be troubled by the idea that God would save particular Latter-day Saint soldiers, singers, or missionaries, and not these children? Or even if we somehow can be so categorical in our thinking, how can we reconcile God's intervention in the lives of half a dozen missionaries in Salt Lake City, or 100 choir members in London, or 38 members of the church who work in the World Trade Center, but the same God does not provide material sustenance for the thousands of Latter-day Saint families who suffer from severe malnutrition, inadequate health care, or acts of violence in Africa, Ecuador, and sometimes on the mean streets of America. Another destructive result of such stories is that they cause deep anguish for the families of military personnel not preserved from the ravages of war or terror. What must the parents, spouse, or children of a soldier killed in Iraq or Afghanistan conclude about the death of their loved one? That either he or she was not worthy of God's special providence, that God is capricious in his grace, that if only their loved one had joined the 457th Engineering Battalion instead of another unit, or carried all of the standard works into battle, they would have been spared? Why wasn't their loved one worthy enough to be classified as, quote, a modern-day stripling warrior? One of the blogs about this story tells the reaction of the story of the Mormon soldiers being preserved in Iraq. This Mormon story, a story told by a mother of an LDS soldier so preserved, she was telling it to her Baptist friend, unaware that her Baptist friend had a son who had been killed in Iraq. A lack of critical thinking also enables Latter-day Saints to believe that God sent Mormon soldiers to fight in Iraq so that the priesthood would be in that part of the world once more, as if there were not an easier, less violent way for God to accomplish this task. The suggestion is also that it was only the power of the priesthood that could bring down a person of such evil as Saddam Hussein. Of course, no one seems to ask the question if the priesthood could capture the evil emperor of Iraq. Why wasn't it powerful enough to bring him down earlier, before he killed so many people, or before we started in a war that has resulted in the death of tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of others? One of the most destructive results of such legends is that it tends to increase Mormon support of the war in Iraq, or at the very least to muzzle any criticisms they might entertain about the moral justification of such a war. If God is using the war to convert others to Mormonism and to restore the priesthood to Babylon, then the war must be justified. Undoubtedly, such sentiments also help explain Latter-day Saints' overwhelming support of the Bush administration. If the president has led us into a God-sanctioned war, as he seems to have claimed, a war that has allowed the Melchizedek priesthood to be reestablished in the ancient land of Abraham, if Mormon soldiers, many of whom are returned missionaries, are indeed God's modern stripling warriors, who not only defeat the proponents of the false religion of Islam and the architects of evil, but who also show thousands of American soldiers the true order of prayer and worship, then how can this not be the inspired decision of a Christian president who feels led by God in his decisions? Further, if God privileges the Latter-day Saints as his modern chosen people, then Latter-day Saints are likely to be unquestioning in their support of God's other chosen people, the Jews, no matter how many innocent civilians they kill in Lebanon or in Gaza in their attempts to retain their habitation of the Promised Land. Thus, the Israelis' fight against Hamas and Hezbollah in the increasingly apocalyptic endgame currently raging in the Middle East becomes the Latter-day Saints' battle as well. Moral complexity is simply ignored or obscured. This is the dark side of the idea of the chosen people or peoples. One of the casualties of such stories is that they undermine those instances where there seems to be a legitimate miracle or a convincing justification for divine intervention, both of which, by the way, I believe in. That is, if we can tell and pass on fraudulent stories and people come to discover that they are false, their faith is inevitably compromised. This reminds me of the experience of one of our youngest daughters when she discovered that the Tooth Fairy, the Easter Bunny, and Santa Claus were not real. Her next question, what about Jesus? In the article about Daniel Gilbert's work on the brain cited above, Sharon Begley writes, Professor Gilbert once asked a religious colleague how he felt about helping to discover that people can misattribute the products of their own minds to acts of God. Professor Gilbert replied, I feel fine. God doesn't want us to confuse our miracles with his. Ironically and tragically, such legends undermine the very foundations of Christianity. The miracle of Christ's mission, including his atonement, is that it was so universal, so democratic, as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. Its great moral challenge and burden is articulated in the 25th chapter of Matthew. There, Christ challenges our tribalism in a way that leaves us no room for escape or excuse, no retreat into callousness or indifference, no self-satisfaction in being his chosen people. If, as the Book of Mormon contends, all are alike unto God, then Palestinians are as valued by him as Israelis, the inhabitants of Darfur as those of Detroit, Sunnis as Latter-day Saints, our neighbors as ourselves. Such legends as those I have discussed today counter Christ's central message of our universal brotherhood and sisterhood. If there is such a thing as chosenness, then surely it must mean not a privileged place in Christ's kingdom, not special providence to save us from the violence and vicissitudes of this spook alley we call life, not a greater measure of grace than others enjoy, but rather a heightened call to service and sacrifice, an enlarged stewardship to participate with Christ in bearing the burdens of the world, an increased compassion for our suffering brothers and sisters, a greater willingness to try with him to descend the harrowing journey beneath all things, and ultimately to consider ourselves, as he does, the least among our fellow beings. Thank you.
I think there is a high potential for a lively question and answer period following my comments, given the nature of the subject. So I've decided to keep my comments brief, for me anyway. And to that end, I've written them down. Also, I should mention that I'm responding to Robert's longer paper. And I think it's fit for publication. And I encourage you to take a look at the longer version of this. I applaud Robert for writing a paper that is both insightful and relevant. I appreciate his courage in addressing this topic of Mormon ethnocentrism, fraught with controversy as it is. And I concur with his description and analysis of the phenomenon and value the key questions he poses, especially when he asks, what do these legends tell us about ourselves? How can we reconcile God's intervention in the lives of some LDS and not other LDS or non-LDS? Is God capricious in his grace? And his daughter's question, what about Jesus? Implying, is he a myth too? Throughout, I found myself asking similar questions. What kind of people create and perpetuate these myths and why? Actually, I'd love to see some psychological profiles. And what kinds of people believe them, and why? Both types of people are needed in this unhealthy symbiosis. I was reminded of Mark Hoffman, who would not have succeeded in his career of creating historical forgeries with anomalous faith-destroying content if a faith versus history crisis had not been there to exploit, and if church leaders had not been eager to pay him large sums of money to buy and then hide and deny the existence of these problematic documents. I remember hearing such myths throughout my Mormon life as a youth, missionary, BYU student, and in later church meetings and informal gatherings. I too was troubled by the notion of a God who saves some but not others. I pondered how Mormons could have it both ways. If one is spared or blessed, it is a reward for righteousness or being one of the chosen. If another is damaged or taken by death, God was testing him for some good purpose, as in the case of Job. Or he was special and God needed him in the spirit world. I could never reconcile this, especially with children for whom agency never allowed them to work out their salvation in this life. For every positive myth, I saw a negative example, like the story I heard in my nearly all-German ward in Milwaukee of the American soldier who shot a German soldier in World War II, only to find a Book of Mormon in his victim's coat, which is a reverse story, variety on a story that Robert told about being saved by the scriptures, saved the bullet that stopped just short of the patriarchal blessing. Robert asks, in effect, do these myths do any harm? And answers with examples of numerous negative outcomes, distinguishing between the unintentional and benign on the one hand, and the more serious fabrications and lies that can and do backfire in terms of promoting faith. I recall my own disillusionment when, years after reading Lundwald's Fate of the Persecutors of Joseph Smith, and Witzow's Joseph Smith the Scientist, and several books on Mormon archaeology, and many others, that the remarkable assertions in these books turned out not to be true. I felt deceived and betrayed and bewildered. Lying for the Lord, or even exaggerating for a cause, is harmful. While legends may bolster belief for the naive, the negative examples, innocent missionaries killed during their mission, or co-eds being kidnapped, or on the greater magnitude side, Hitler and Stalin killing their 6 and 27 million people before being taken by God. These negative messages connote too powerful a contradiction. I see this as a universal or a ubiquitous problem in what I'll call self-righteous faith cultures, Jews, Catholics, Baptists, Mormons, and others who are chosen or believe that they are the exclusively true religious group. Such groups teach a faith consistent with Paul's definition as the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. This non-rational, non-proof, non-science, non-evidence-based belief is difficult for rational, critical thinking humans who lack direct concept with gods, who are the source and focus of their belief. Most believers, I maintain, are insecure in their faith, so much so that some set out to prove it to be true. How long will farms and Book of Mormon archaeologists and apologist authors persist in this quest? This problem is not unique to the LDS culture. It has existed since ancient days. It is now widely believed by archaeologists, biblical scholars, and historians that the Hebrew nation came into existence between 1200 and 1300 BC, not thousands of years earlier, as the Old Testament or Pentateuch maintain. Thus, the ancient prophets we revere were fictional, fictional creations to give their creators an authoritative lineage and scripture. The Jesus Seminar says the same about the scriptural claims for Jesus' divinity, miracles, and resurrection. These ideas were added later by those needing to manufacture stronger faith through binding myths. The Catholic and other Christian traditions have done the same with their miracles and saints and mysterious mysticisms and altered documents. Robert explains how myths help us believe we are extraordinary by indirect vicarious association, even if we are not extraordinary. Is this harmful? I think that believing lies are truths is harmful and lead to dire consequences like the Mountain Meadows Massacre on the dark side and spiritual confusion or corrosion on the individual level. Look at the terrible outcomes of the American belief in manifest destiny. And in our culture, we have the equivalent, which Annie Brewer calls Mormonfest destiny. The outcomes on Native Americans, Blacks, Gentiles, and others. I recall after attending a week of LifeSpring, which is a secular, experiential, self-actualization kind of workshop, the story of a wheelchair-bound man who drowned trying to swim across San Francisco Bay after being encouraged by another LifeSpring group to believe the myth that he could do so. I suppose mythical fishing and golfing stories are harmless, but why do we need to create the Manti plates? Do you remember this story of these metal plates that were found down in San Pete County and had hieroglyphics, ancient hieroglyphics, and the locator maintained that they were written by Moroni when he came out to dedicate the site of the Manti Temple after a little walk from New York to Manti, I presume. And it turns out that these were made out of 20-gauge copper that had been treated with a certain acid and etched with a number 14 awl, and they were cattle brands that had been manipulated into Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics or something. And this story, which got a lot of press at the time, was very faith-promoting to people, and then the very same people were distressed when it turned out to be a hoax. And on a more serious level, what about the 9 versions of the first vision, each one more detailed and more dramatic than the last? Has not the church news disseminated such misinformation for generations? I remember when I read it as a youth, reading many of these kinds of stories. What about the Mormon proclivity to believe that we are the first and the best in everything, even if they're dubious categories? The claim that ZCMI was the first department store, that we had the world's first traffic light on First South in Maine, we have the biggest open pit mine. None of these is true. We have the most Republican voting state. Dismayingly, that is true. We're the inventors of the Humvee, the rubber chicken, and Kentucky Fried Chicken, and who cares if it's true? More seriously, Robert's paper is especially useful in integrating the findings of various scholars and providing insights on the negative outcomes of believing in the untrue. I agree with his observations. Spiritual arrogance is unchristlike. An untrue belief in God or a belief in an untrue God who is capricious, discriminate, arbitrary, contradictory, and hypocritically unreliable is harmful, because if we pattern ourselves after him, we can justify ourselves in becoming and acting the same. Creating, perpetuating, and believing in myths, whether urban, suburban, or rural, and I suggest that the word urban be taken out of the title, even though it appears in some other literature. It's really religious, not urban. Believing these things can and will have a reversed effect on faith and behavior among the more thoughtful believers. Finally, Robert tries at the end to deal with the dilemma of being chosen. Because it is so scripturally centered, this notion is a trap from which there is no easy escape, and it contaminates us all. But I like Robert's last paragraph and his call for a more enlightened interpretation of this notion. And I'm just going to read the last sentence. He proposes that chosenness is a heightened call to service and sacrifice and enlarged stewardship to participate with Christ in bearing the burdens of the world and increased compassion for our suffering brothers and sisters, a greater willingness to try with him to descend the harrowing journey beneath all things and ultimately to consider ourselves as he does, the least among our fellows. Thank you.
Before we open for questions, I just wanted to just say one of the things that leads me to investigate these kinds of stories is not because, as I said before, that I don't believe in God, because I do, or that I don't believe in the restoration, which I do, or that I don't believe in miracles, which I do, but because I think we undermine the very core ideals of our religious society by believing in and perpetuating falsehood, or worse than that, not doing the kind of critical thinking that we need to do. And I'll give you a good example of this. I was watching CNN news during the Katrina disaster, and one of the cameras came into a church that had been destroyed, and trees had fallen, and there was a statue of the Virgin Mary, and they said, it's a miracle that this statue was preserved. And other people, it was repeated elsewhere. And I want to say, what's wrong with you people that you don't think about a God who would save a statue of the Virgin Mary, but not these hundreds of people who are dying or this city? And not doing that kind of critical thinking, I think, is a spiritual laziness, which undermines the very core of what it means to be a person of faith. So, anyway, if and it is. Let me just say one word further about that. It is a sensitivity to that. In our state conference, or in our ward not too long ago, a sister stood up on, or the member of the bishopric stood up on Fast Sunday and said, I see Sister so-and-so and her baby in sitting down in the congregation, and they were in an automobile accident this week, but the Holy Ghost formed a protective core around them and they weren't seriously injured. I was aware that sitting a couple of pews away was a brother, one of the best men that I know, whose wife has not been in church for many years because of her sister and a nephew and other family members being killed in an automobile accident and her inability to reconcile those deaths. And part of me always is thinking about, how does this sound to somebody else? The sister who stands up in state conferences in our stake not too long ago and talked about how she was out of work for a long time, but she prayed and fasted and the Lord helped her find a job, and sitting on the stand was a member of the High Council, as good a man as I know, who had been without work for an entire year, and who had fasted and prayed and done all kinds of other things. So the sensitivity to how what we claim as God's intervention in our lives, and how that may appear or seem to other people. And so part of it in these urban legends is that I think they do undermine some of those core sensitivities. So if any of you has questions for Alan or me, we'd be happy to have you come and ask them. Or if you have any great urban legends to perpetuate.
I just wanted to say there are a couple of copies of Robert's book, Proving Contraries, in the Harvest Room, if anyone's interested in those.
Thank you. You all have to buy that book, not because it does anything for me, because if you don't know Gene England, that will help you know him better.
I'm curious whether you took a crack at something that I wonder is documentably true, that the Relief Society is the largest and oldest women's organization in the world. Maybe not a follow-up to that specifically, but how do we go about combating or I guess gently unraveling these tall tales that good people believe, whether they're true or not? Just wondering.
Okay, that's a good question, and Alan's certainly free to respond as well. My question, or my response to whether Relief Society is the oldest and the largest, is who cares? What kind of a society is the Relief Society? Not how old it is or how big it is. How many Mormons are there, and whether they were the first to invent the rubber chicken or something else. Some of these are simply irrelevant. And also, there are things that it's not possible to prove. I mean, who is going to do a study of all of the women's organizations? But even if it were, And I make a distinction between those urban legends which are pretty harmless and which we all tell. I mean, we all tell stories in our families. I have one of my children is often appropriates stories from someplace else and tells them as if they were hers. And I think, well, that's interesting. So, but how do we counter them? I think we counter them by raising questions about them. In our ward, there over the past couple of years, there was a story told, and it was repeated, at least told twice by the same person, which is this nun in Germany who was converted to the church, and she was a doctor of theology, and she had taught all of these priests when she was a doctor of theology, and then she was converted to the church, and she took some more missionaries back to the seminary and knocked on the door, and they went in and preached the gospel to these priests. Well, I wrote to Elder Neuenschwander, who was the area president when my wife and I served as missionaries in the Baltic States, and I said, this story has been circulating. Is there any truth to it? And he wrote back and said, well, there was such a sister, but all of these things that are claimed are things that have been added on. So that kind of elaboration, which it seems to me has to be, in some instances, deliberate intents to falsify. So I think one of them is to question those stories when we hear them, to say, could this possibly be true? If it's too good to be true, it probably isn't true. So I think part of it is respectfully, I mean, I don't think anyone needs to get up and say, you're telling a lie, but I think it's to say, what is the source of this? And it's, interestingly enough, this is exactly what the brethren have asked us to do. I didn't have time to read both Elder Ballard and President Hinckley's statements about this, and also Elder Harold B. Lee, who talked about how Mormons have this propensity to perpetuate gossip and rumor, and President Lee is just appalled. It never ceases to amaze me how gullible some of our church members are in rebroadcasting these sensational stories or dreams or visions, some alleged to have been given by the church by leaders past and present, without first verifying the report with proper church authorities. So challenge, verify, and qualify if you say, you know, this doesn't sound like it's really true.
There are lots of variations on that question. BYU is the largest privately owned religious university. Mormonism is the fastest growing religion, and it goes on and on and on. We apparently not only have a need to be first, but to ask these kinds of questions. There is an interesting series of articles in the current Newsweek. I'm pretty sure it's Newsweek. It might be U.S. News and World Report. It's a front cover article, and it's about a dozen or so stories in the secular world. Was Perry or Cook the first to arrive at the North Pole? It turns out probably neither one actually got it accurately. And inventing certain medicines and the computer. And so this issue was about the first to do this, that, and the other. And then the final essay asks the question, why is it important to be the first? And I commend it to you because it addresses the exact same issues we've been talking about today. And the quotations from these church leaders are significant because they have gone on record in conference meetings and in writing discouraging this kind of activity of making up and then perpetuating these stories. But it doesn't seem to be enough. I think this advice of theirs hasn't come across strong enough, perhaps because it hasn't hurt badly enough. But they're on the record as saying, don't believe these things, and yet I think we can find evidence when they were in part responsible for creating them and starting them in the first place.
Back to the legends on this war that you opened with. I've had a question in my heart. I lost a young son, 17 years old. And I, as a mother, would like to know, how do governments raise armies of Christian people to kill each other? And even sing songs like Onward Christian Soldiers to kill each other. And I'm curious if, in fact, this legend hasn't been perpetrated to raise an army, even yet in this place where I am seeing beautiful young men join up in this ridiculous conflict.
Well, I think that There's no question that urban legends are used for propaganda purposes. There is only an academic distinction between certain kinds of propaganda and urban legends. Urban legends would seem to emerge out of the folk as opposed to those that are deliberately falsified. And we know that their governments of all kinds are notorious for teaching us that, in fact, what we look up and see is a clear sky when it's full of smog, or whatever else it is that we are told. It is the destructive part of this is that, as Ezra Pound, speaking about the First World War, talked about the thousands, the hundreds of thousands of young men who went to death, he said, for speaking of civilization, for an old bitch gone in the teeth and a batch of battered books. These are more serious things, and the answer to your question deserves probably 5 or 6 hours of thoughtful consideration, but thank you for raising it.
One other comment on that. A quote I have, one of the many quotes, is that religion tries to create solace for the turmoil it creates. And Adolf Hitler gave as one of his public defenses of his extermination of Jews the notion that that group was responsible for the killing of Jesus, and so he was trying to use a Christian rationale. But one of the valuable things about Robert's paper at the very end is he ties the Mormon support of the idea of Israel being the chosen and we being the chosen as well, that we're the second group of chosen. And then George Bush being a Christian, God-fearing president to whom God actually speaks as to the Mormon prophet, ties all of those ideas together with the conclusion that that's why Mormons support this war and support Bush's activities and support Republican agenda, because we can't escape this tradition that we have and use critical thinking to think our way out of it to a better tradition.
I do believe that the monthly fast and testimony meetings are the perfect place for the perpetuation of myth. Now, what I would like to see is for those of us who have had negative experiences, not spiritual, but negative experiences, things have gone wrong during the month, receive equal time in the testimony meetings.
Let me say something about testimony meetings. I think testimony meetings represent the potential for the best and the worst that might be represented in our community. As a bishop, I deputized my executive council. I said, when things start getting too crazy, you guys start standing up, as sometimes they did. Testimony meetings to me have provided some of the most meaningful spiritual experiences of my life. I believe the testimony meetings are essentially a good thing, but there's no question that there are a number of things in these meetings to which people bear testimony would fit under the rubric of urban legends. And again, if you look at this book, Us and Them, which is about a study of the brain and the brain's ability to separate all of these facts and put the good ones on our side and the bad ones on the other side, to build a case for whatever it is we want to believe, then it is natural that we do that. But I think there's nothing wrong with someone standing in testimony meeting. And for example, one of the good things about the very powerful film on Joseph Smith over at the used to be the Hotel Utah, whatever it's called now, is when Emma asked Joseph, why didn't God enter? She sees her husband blessing and saving all these people. And she said, why didn't God save our son? For which Joseph has no answer. And we need to tell those stories more. Sometimes, you know, I, in my high priest group meeting, when somebody gives a lesson on, you know, priesthood blessings and how they cure, I talk about the fact that as a priesthood holder, I laid my hands on the head of someone who died, and I didn't tell her that she wasn't going to die. And I said, you know, it's a terrible responsibility to hold the priesthood and have the responsibility of giving blessings. It scares the heck out of me to be called to give a blessing. But I think we need to talk about the times it doesn't work as well as the times that does, because there are people whose hearts are broken when they think, my son's going on a mission, he's going to be saved, and that son goes on a mission and is killed. And they begin to wonder, what's wrong with me? Or what was wrong with my son? Or what is God? So I think being more realistic in talking about these things is a constructive thing to do, without trying to say, okay, everybody on this side, get up and tell a negative story, and you guys tell a positive story, and we'll try to balance this out. But I think it is appropriate at times to talk about, in fast host meeting or in sacrament meetings, when things don't go right, because sometimes they don't.
Back to the issue of bigness, why do we care about having the biggest relief society, et cetera, biggest women's organization? Where are we? We're in Salt Lake, which is, you know, the global center of Mormonism, but it is indeed the second most economically and populous city in what is by far the least populous and economically productive of the four major time zones in the U.S. We're not that large in a lot of ways. We want to be big somehow. So I guess I understand that. That urge. In terms of the Relief Society being the largest women's organization, it's a Sunstone urban legend that it's the largest women's organization run by men. And my one of the reposts of one of my more orthodox female friends is, it's the largest women's organization that men think they run.
Steve Martin was on Terry Gross on NPR, and he dispelled the myth that he wasn't a Mormon, which I thought was hilarious. But have there been any studies done about other religious sects that are as gullible as the LDS people here in Utah, where they succumb to multi-marketing schemes like they do in Utah? Do you know of any? Because don't you think that we're susceptible to con artists and things?
Well, I think Utah has long been known as the golden fleece capital of the world, the place where there is more chicanery and more of this. And one could say the bright side of that is that Mormons are so trusting that they can be gulled so easily. The dark side of that is that a lot of the gulling is done by Mormons. I think all religions, the degree to which a religion sees itself as exclusive and divinely appointed favorite of God, the more likely you are to have these kinds of legends. But all peoples create urban legends. We are not the only ones. We're not the only ones that create the kinds of legends I've talked about today. I think all of us, you examine stories that are told in your families, and you know that a lot of them aren't really true, or they aren't true the way they're reported. We have this wonderful ability to weave narratives. And a lot of them are harmless. It's making the distinction between the ones that are harmless and ones that are harmful, and the repeating those in ways that undermine faith and undermine our confidence in God, that are the ones that concern me.
Our time is up. In fact, we're a little over time. We'd like to thank everybody for coming out. Thank you for our...